You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, KTAH, Radio Tacoma, 101.9 LP. And we're very, very happy today to have with us a Port Townsend poet, Linda Robertson. She is well-traveled. She has lived in many parts of the Americas, at least as far as different regions, from San Diego to Metau country in Washington, and presently is in residence in a lovely artist's community, I would imagine, in Port Townsend. She has a publication from some years ago called The Reply of Leaves, and so we will be asking Linda what she says when she speaks to the trees. And she is a poet of a great, very conversant with nature, is the way I would put it. Welcome, Linda, to Sound Poetry.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Would you like to begin by reading a poem?
Sure. I just finished a full-length collection called The Missing that I'm going to be sending out. And this is the first poem. I've traveled to Europe quite a bit, and I visited a lot of chapels. And I had been seeing a lot of Madonna and Child paintings and sculptures. And I thought about the idea of child and using metaphor. And so I wrote this poem. It's called Child. The child is mainland, a lighthouse atop gannet-thick cliffs. The child is almanac, chart of tides, moonrise, chain of days. The child holds claim to breath like a diamond narrows its thief. The child's cry becomes canon, child of halo, of lion, of timber and nail, child of caravan and crossings. One pilgrim follows, secrets a coin in her seam.
That is based on a Madonna and Child icon, or from several?
Several. And it just started, that just was the seed of the inspiration for that. And my collection, The Missing, it really is a theme of the collection. It's based on Stanley Kunitz's wonderful poem called The Layers. And the epigraph for my book is, how can the heart be reconciled to its feasts of losses? And my son, who was killed in British Columbia in the mountains when he was 20 years old. Oh. And it's been something that, of course, affects your heart forever. And some of the work is kind of my reconciling that and finding him and writing about losses. And then also, I'm of the age now that my mother just passed a few years ago, and she was 96. I've been, you know, very involved with elderly parents and making a big move and transitioning. So there's a lot of losses, you know, and then what you find as you change in your life and traveling and transitions too.
Yes. Yeah. Your mother was important in early days with your poetry too, I recall.
Yes, she was. My mother was Catherine, and she was born in 1920. And part of her education growing up was a lot of memorizing poems. And so I was growing up, and we'd spend time on the beach in San Diego. So often I can remember her, you know, reciting Tennyson or Wordsworth or poems. And so that really keened my ear. And I also think that growing up in the Catholic Church, when the Mass was still recited in Latin, I maybe didn't always know what we were singing, but the sound of the language, the sound of the word and the cadences, that just really imprinted and impressed on me. And also, we've had a number of women, especially women on my mother's side of the family, the Tellocs, the Scot-Irish, that wrote verse all their lives. They were from the later 1800s. My mother wasn't a writer in terms of verse. She wrote letters, but her mother and my great aunts, and so I feel like I carry it in my DNA, really.
Yes, yes. I have some of your poems here. Are they the ones you sent me from The Missing, there was one called A Searchlight Evan. There was another, Against Leaving, mm-hmm. A Pilgrim's Way. Do any of those belong to the same collection? Yeah,
they're all in the same collection. There's four different sections.
Read one of those. Yes. Okay. Go ahead. Sure. Continue with this one, The Missing.
These are from the Metal Valley. I'll read two that you have one of. The Metal Valley is just absolutely gorgeous in the springtime. And I had been away to actually San Diego with my parents, and I came back and I wrote this. It's called After 10 Days Away. Return to a world roused, so much desire in the wind. Meadow larks betray our yearning. Small birds gift mullion with deepest sky, wear rivers on their wings. This morning, I believe nothing has been lost. Blossoms on serviceberry shrubs thread mountain light down nearby swales. One red-tailed hawk, a compass above us. There is no going without returning. And then I can read just this other poem that was I wrote as I was leaving the Metau and moving. It's called Against Leaving. Later I will say the hills conspired. Crowds of balsam root and lupin hindered my passage, my shoulders bound by snowthrift clouds. Not one clock struck the hour. I leaned toward the broadest yellow pine, the flags of prayer, where a male grouse stood sentry. The maple tree sheltered the bird bull's sheen, a last offering, the distances before me inscribed with raven wings.
Yes, you love birds very much. I've picked up on that. And in the one After 10 Days Away, where you speak of the small birds gift mullein with deepest sky, how does that mullein fit in there? A lot might not be familiar with mullein.
Right, so it's a plant that grows, and often in the fields, especially in the spring, it's quite tall on stalks. And over, after it's dried up from the last season, it's full of seeds. So their seed heads are quite tall. They can be 3 or 4 feet tall. And the mountain bluebirds, who are vivid, vivid blue, deep blue, come to those. And you'll be walking through a field. Those small bluebirds are on the tips of the mullein. It's beautiful. So that's right. What that refers to.
So much to be learned in a phrase like that. Yes, yeah. That's right. The scattering of the seeds by birds. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very good. And after leaving, this was some years ago then.
Against Leaving. I wrote that in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you have gone back there periodically. Do you go back to rejuvenate a certain Metau feeling?
I have. It's actually been 2 years since I've been back, just because I had some other things that were pressing that I couldn't go to the Metau for several years. But I hope to go back after all of this sheltering in place is over. I was hoping to go back in the spring. I absolutely love the spring there. The trails are open and the all the wildflowers, the lupin and balsam root and all that are in beautiful bloom. And there's still some snow on the high peaks in the North Cascades. The birds are all coming through. It's really a gorgeous time to be there.
Alpine landscapes.
It's steppe sage, so it's dry. You know, we have the bitterroot and sagebrush and pines and aspen. Yeah, it depends
on how you are. What is the elevation there?
Our house was, 1700, I think, is Winthrop. It's not very high.
Yes, but the town of Winthrop. And Metau is a river too, is it not?
Yes. It's the Metau River drainage. And the Metau comes out of the North Cascades up by Mazama and then goes down about 45, I think, about miles and feeds the Columbia River.
In those years, did you just wander the trails and think of your poems and then write them down later? Or did you have a notebook and put some images down as you conceived them? How did you work?
Well, I was, when I was raising my children and they were young, I had a notebook in my car and I had a notebook in my purse and in my pocket. The Reply of Leaves was published quite a long time ago, and that is more Metow poems. And those were written being out on trails. We had 30 acres and we had 1,200 acres behind us. So there was a lot of open land and all the animals coming through and things that we saw. So many of my poems would start with an image. I would see an image of something and it would just kind of keep circling in my brain until I'd have to do something about it. Before the internet, I really wanted to be writing and I didn't have any mentors or any way of being in school there. There were no universities or any way to go to university at that time. The University of Washington had some distance learning classes that they offered through the mail. And so I did take a couple of beginning verse classes through the mail with Christiane Balk, which were wonderful for me. And she kind of got me started and would recommend, oh, you know, have you ever read Mary Oliver? Or have you ever read so-and-so? So she really opened so many doors for me. And that was really the beginning of my writing more regularly.
Yes. From the Reply of Leaves, do you want to read us a couple of those poems, which are a little older?
I'll read Up Twist River. There were cougar hunts in the Metow Valley, and I had been down in Twisp, and I saw a truck with some type of a camper kind of thing on the back, and there were hound dogs in the enclosed back, and then there was a dead cougar on top of the camper thing. And so I talked to some people about what happened during cougar hunting, and I wrote this poem called Up Twist River.
Good.
Five dogs, eager, taut-muscled hounds, lunged up Twist River, led by the cougar's scent on the heavy, sodden snow. Imagine the chase. 3 miles up, they encircled her at the river's edge in haunch-deep, bloody snow, a deer leg ragged in her claws. She leapt up a shaggy-limbed pine, stretched upwards towards the somber, slate-colored sky, and clung there. 2 men followed the noise from transmitter collars, the shrill yelps, the frantic baying, to the scene of snarl and scream. 1 man raised his rifle, aimed, held it steady. Her long, tawny body dropped through the cool, turbulent air. Imagine that cougar's final growl as a futile sort of prayer for wings or mercy, just as improbable and as rare.
Yes, it seems that the cougar hunt is something that the dogs enjoy more than the human beings, to just point a gun up there in a tree and shoot a cougar. The dogs have done the job.
Yes. Yeah,
it's an interesting, there's a sadness about that kind of hunt, I think. And you've put a bit of that in there with the imagining the cougar's final thoughts,
mm-hmm.
wishing for wings, yes.
Yeah.
Would you like to read one about your own life when you were 10? That's got quite a memory to it, I'm sure, for you.
That's funny. Yeah, that's not from the Metow, but
no, from the earlier days. Yes.
Yeah. So when I was 10 years old, I was on my brother's bike that I was not supposed to be riding in the neighborhoods of San Diego, and my girlfriend that I was riding with, she cut in front of me, and I went over and I broke my femur. Snap. And I was 10 years old, and that was that for the summer. I was in the hospital for 2 months in traction at Children's Hospital. So this brings back some memories of that time. The summer I was 10, Children's Hospital, San Diego, California. 56 days in a tight sheeted bed. A silver triangle hung above my head like a trapeze, but for me there would be no chance to leap and glide the summer I was 10. The too big bike I was forbidden to ride had betrayed me. A sudden swerve off the curb and down I had crashed from a perilous height, shrieking about the leg that had snapped mid-thigh. No warm curve of cats for company, no coming and going of next-door friends, no running or skating or ponies, no swimming or somersaults, no climbing, only that long lying, held to the bed by cable and weights, and the slim steel rod bored through my knee, meant to keep my leg still and straight. 56 days I leaned away from the chiming bells, from the hollow voices in the halls, from the racket of wheels rolling, from the side-stepping nurses with thermometers and pills and Dixie cups, from trays that brought food scooped into geometric shapes, towards the room's only window, towards the white-bellied seagulls that hovered and called, towards the evenings when my parents' sun-warmed hands eased me into sleepiness, where I dove and stretched and floated in the ocean's salty foam the summer I was 10.
Yes, you had your first experience with severe quarantining there, huh?
Yes, I did.
And when you wrote that, did you write many versions of it through the years that it became this poem, or did you simply work on that during 20 years ago before you published this book?
No, you know, I think it might have come out of an idea of just reading. I probably had read something about memory, you know, to write something, a prompt about writing about something that had important in your life, something that had happened. And so I just wrote that. It's funny because my father was never keen on me being a poet or a writer. He didn't think that it was very important work and it didn't make any money. So he wasn't too, you know, enthusiastic about it. But when he read that poem, and I think it was because I named him and, you know, how my parents came and visited me and eased me in the evening, he's always said, "I really like that poem."
The beginning of acceptance there, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I've written about him since then now. He's in some of my newer work.
Yes, okay. With that experience, do you often think back on that sort of isolation in a bed during these times where we are more or less, well, we're cooped up, if anything, and have much more limitations on our activities? Do you find that this is a good time for poetry?
Well, there's two different questions. So the first question, do I look back on that time? I think that I realized at some point that time really helped me become a very good reader, which lends to becoming a writer, right? Because that's all I could do. I was laid out in a bed. The Children's Hospital had a library that they would wheel my bed into, and I read and read and read. There really wasn't television. This was 1965, not much TV and all that. So, and it's funny how sometimes you'll read biographies or autobiographies of writers or artists, and often in their young life, they've had something happen where they've been infirmed or they've been had to be away from other people. I feel like that had some very profound effect on me. In terms of now, I live in a really beautiful spot where I can go out and go walking, and there's trails right by my house, and I walk right down to the beach and it's open. I'm able to get out a lot. And in terms of poetry, I am probably busier with poetry now than I was before, because everybody's gone online and there's all these different groups of people that are meeting online to have live poetry readings. And there's a lot of poets that I know that had books that were just published this spring. A lot of them are doing readings online to help promote their books. Some of the small presses are putting out, or even, you know, larger presses are having readings that will, so people can tune in on Zoom or watch later on Facebook or on their websites and watch poetry. So actually poetry is just really rich and thriving right now.
It seems as though there is some meaning being instilled in it by even a journalistic report saying, here's a poem for the day, or mm-hmm. I came across this poem recently. You wouldn't have normally seen that in some journals, but now it does seem to be important to put in a poetic verse or so. But the music too is very yeah. important, I'm sure, for people.
Yeah. I wrote a poem about being sheltered in place.
Let's hear that one. Yes, that'd be good.
So this is my most recent poem. It's written in a letter form. It's a letter written during COVID-19 shelter in place, week 6. Dear Solace, sometimes you are nothing more than sky or two does browsing nearby green beneath cedars. Or an eagle that claims the same limb over and over, whistling to the far away, 5 o'clock sunlight weaving its way through alder woods, tracking a gray squirrel's runaway tail. I discover you occasionally in the jigsaw puzzle with pieces enough to fill a quarter of the dining table. I join edges, then the vigorous violet sky, the rough alpine peaks. I am on my way to the lake that blurs all that rises above it. Will you be there? Today, old heartbreaks wash through me like rain. There seems no window I can close. Until I notice a heart-shaped vase filled with all hues of blue beach glass. A pair of tall Madonna votives. A photograph of myself and my blue-eyed husky forever paired in a field of balsam root and lupin on a May Day's trail. In this time of separations, you often bring mother's palm to my forehead as I wake, though she's more than 3 years dead. Yesterday, you were a young seal in Discovery Bay, watching me, watching him. And the news of a small band of Mustangs trucked from Texas Kilpin to California Sanctuary. You arrive on Sundays by telephone with my Irish friends, their voices, their poems. Solace, what did I assume? That during this long solitude, the hummingbirds might forget to return? The apricot begonia refuse its blooms?
Life just floods in during a solace, right? Yes, in our soliloquies, we often think of tranquility, silence, and so on. And yet, you have there a great deal of music, a menagerie of creatures, landscapes, and so forth, personalities appearing. Yeah, that's very wonderful. The sound of poetry as music was mentioned in the Meadow Valley Arts piece, that this is particularly something that you wish to emphasize in your poetry.
Well, I think, yes, the lyric quality, I think, is important to me for the most part. It depends on what I'm writing. I choose words not only for what they mean, but how they sound. And when you're writing a poem and you're drafting and you're revising and re-envisioning, I'm reading aloud to myself. And I'm listening, what does it sound like? Yes, I do pay attention to sound, absolutely.
And reading poems aloud is really, it's necessary for the performance of what you have in just mute words sitting on the page there. Do you read poetry out loud by yourself when you're at home?
Sometimes I do, sure. I have my own and others, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do you record yourself?
I have been recorded. I actually was going to talk about a little bit. I had a collection of 5-letter poems that I wrote that were published by the Metau Conservancy as part of a project with beautiful coffee table book, fine art press book that included my 5 letters. They're called Letters to Julia, 1898 to 1899, the Meadow Valley. So the poems are written in a letter form, if in the voice of a young woman coming up to homestead in the Meadow Valley in, you know, very in late 1800s. And those have been recorded. And I'm actually working right now with someone. I'm creating a website, and I just would like to share more of my work. And I don't have a lot of publications. It's not something that I've really put a lot of energy into so far. I've been published in journals and I've had some publications, but I'm creating a website and there will be links on there to some readings. And I have had the letters to Julia, those letters have been recorded. Yeah.
Do you have any of the letters nearby right now?
I do.
Why don't you give us a sample of that? Okay. This has been recorded, but here we have a re-recording of one of your letters.
So these were written, as I said, in the voice of a young woman coming up into the Mattel Valley by wagon in 1898. And I used the names of Catherine, who is my mother's name, and her older sister, Julia, who they're both passed now. So this is the first letter of the series, Spring 1898. Spring 1898. Dearest Julia, these last days of travel, our wagons shadow the river. Steelhead and salmon broadcast silvery news of our progress. When we rest, we count stars. Night's unfolding is endless, composed of radiance, a roll of astral sheet music unfurled between opposing horizons. We sleep back to back with the dogs, keeping them from the coyotes yipping their names. In the wind, a warning of wolves. One long-eared owl replies to our prayers. Bunch grass, belly deep to the horses, escorts the wayfaring river. Yellow pine, aspen, red twig dogwood, willow, cottonwood. Eagles note our arrival, their heads and tails feathered with snow. Mallards, river otters, kingfishers, there seems fish enough for all. Where the voices of two rivers unite, an encampment. Each teepee sided with bulrush and yellowed canvas sails. Racks of drying fish, bitterroot. Ponies staked together stamp their hooves against the dust. Plated baskets bulge with roots of wild carrot and onion. Dogs attend each of us with wary eyes. Steadfast snow on sentinel peaks endure. Proof of the cartographer's glacial hand. Wind so keen, we nearly weep. Your loving sister, Catherine.
Well, who wouldn't want to have a letter like that sent to them? That's very beautiful. You culled that out of some historical form, right?
I lived in the Mattel up on a piece of property for 26 years, and behind our house there was evidence of an old homestead, and that really became part of my imagination. And yes, there is an old museum in town that has the history. I knew some of the history of the Mattel Valley. I didn't want to read anybody else's work and words. I ended up with this project that I did called, Letters to Julia, 1898 to 1899. And there's five letters. That first one is spring, and then the next one was summer, fall, winter, and then the next spring. So it kind of covers the first year and the seasons, and it kind of speaks to the hardships, the work, and the worry. And it's a tough place to live, even with all the amenities, even with all the conveniences of having running water and electricity and all that. And so I really wanted to honor the lives and the struggles and the joys of those women, especially that came not knowing really what they were coming into and making a life and having families and all that.
Yeah, it's a very inventive project. That was very, very interesting to hear. You have you one that is of really fresh, recent vintage?
I belong to a group of, there's five of us poets. And we women poets here in Port Townsend write together. We call ourselves Spot Ons, and we go to different places all throughout the county, and we'll find something as we go and visit parks and trails and antique malls and whatever museums. We will try to give ourselves an assignment of finding something that sparks a poem for each of us. And so I had gone out to Maristone Island, which is quite near me, and there's Fort Flagler is out there. And I saw this sign that said portable searchlight storage. And that just stayed with me. And so when I came home, I wrote this poem, and I wrote it in memory of my son, Evan, who died in the mountains when he was 20. Searchlight for Evan. How far can it reach this eye of light? I would aim its sight towards his last living day or further, to years lit with snowfall and alpine lakes traced by a boy on a board, to morning hours reflecting burnished eyes, the sheen of his hair, astonished smile. Tonight, the quarter moon is a scar that burns upon this world altered. His future slipped from mine by a glacier's sudden shiver. In a dream, I traverse the crest where sky joins earth, forage through time's talus and shale for boot prints, an agile echo, breathy relic. How far can it reach this star of sight? If only I could send its arc through the night so he might follow its radiance back to me.
Very poignant, very poignant. Yes, very heartfelt, that with much searching. Yes, this has been a pleasure, Linda. You've been listening to the musical poetry, the poetry of all nature by Linda M. Robertson of Port Townsend, and we have enjoyed very much on Radio Tacoma Sound Poetry to have you as one of our interviewees. Loved it very much. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me, and it was wonderful to meet you.